And what it is, it's self-control. I think that self-control is just all over the Bible. Stop and think about it. You know, any place you want to look, you're going to find that. Now, you won't find the words there, but you're going to find that there. I was just thinking a moment ago, before we sang the last song, about a couple passages there at the end of Ephesians 4, where there are things to avoid, and then there are things that need to be done on the part of a Christian. And I thought, you know, both of those would be things that would require self-control. You need self-control to do something. You need self-control not to do something. So it's kind of something that cuts both ways. If you turn to Proverbs chapter 25, Proverbs chapter 25 is where we're going to start tonight. And I decided to use this as the text. And as a matter of fact, mentioned it on my wall on Facebook earlier in the week. Some of you may have seen it. It says here at the end, whoever has no rule over his own spirit is like a city broken down without walls. Well, that would be talking about self-control, having rule over his own spirit. We've got to admit that the person who can practice self-control is someone who will come out way ahead on things and be successful in the cause of the Lord. But then, control. Now, just think about control. Not necessarily self-control, but control, any kind of control. That's long been a prized objective throughout history. You think about the number of battles that have been fought to gain control over something or someone. And there have been non-violent means used to seek self-control. Do you recall back in the Old Testament story of account of what happened after the death of Solomon? There was Rehoboam, who was his son, and then there was another fellow by the name of Jeroboam. Now, Jeroboam, you might at sometimes call him a usurper or a pretender or something like that. Well, he wanted the kingdom also. So there was this kind of a conflict a little bit. Jeroboam finally took off. Well, he didn't hang around where Rehoboam was at, but now it didn't mean that he stopped. He went up to the north a little bit, kind of settled up there and in and around Shechem. That's Samaria of later history. But while he was there, he kind of set up himself as a ruler in opposition to Rehoboam. And he says in 1 Kings chapter 12 and verse 26 that now this was a big concern for him. You can read all 25 through 33. I'm not going to read it all, but that's where this is found. He said in his heart, now the kingdom may return to the house of David. Now, he had made some inroads, you see, in getting people to follow him and to recognize him as the one who ought to be leading Israel. And his concern was, well, something may happen here, and it all goes awry. So what he decided to do, he realized, you know, the people go down to the house of the Lord in Jerusalem and offer sacrifices, and some of them may not come back, or some of them may go down there, and they may come back, and they may, you know, throw me out, and they may even kill me. So I don't want them to go down there to Jerusalem. So his idea was, I need to control this. And the way he controlled it was he set up two places for worship, one in Bethel, one up in Dan, golden calves to worship, and thinking, well, this will keep the people at home. So it's a nonviolent way of trying to control people. And I think that we can see that just very evident in those in that account. And here's another thing, and I've always found this interesting. Sometimes the very one who insists on self-control in others is found to lack self-control himself. Lived in Indiana until I was 40 years old. And, of course, Indiana's known for a number of things. We're known for I guess, the Indianapolis 500. That's one of the things. And we're known for, you know, basketball, especially high school basketball, being a big thing. And trust me, it's just the biggest thing going. And I always thought, you know, the third thing was finding wild mushrooms in the springtime. That was always a big thing with me. But when you talk about basketball, back when I was living in Indiana, it was always about Bobby Knight. And here's Bobby Knight, coach, and a successful coach when he's in Indiana. Well, anywhere he was. But he was a man, as a coach, that demanded his players be in control of themselves all the time when they're out there on the floor. And yet, if you glanced over him on the sidelines, he was completely out of control. Sometimes it seemed like out of his mind. And I always thought that was interesting. I guess what you call a paradox. But so sometimes people that insist on self-control, you know, and others aren't practicing too much of it themselves. But one of the things for sure is our text that we looked at there in Proverbs is one that addresses self-control. And here's something that I said when I put this on Facebook, that it seems to me that self-control is something that many of us are convinced we have a handle on, when actually few of us do. And I think that's it. And you know, we sometimes think, well, I don't need this, but actually it is something that we do need. But let's start off by just answering the question, what is self-control? Now, if the King James Version doesn't have self-control, it has an older word, temperance, which was a perfectly acceptable word. It's a fine word. I think the only drawback to temperance is that temperance became associated with a group of people, the Temperance Society, who, you know, decided to have people practice some control in drinking by going in and running people out with weapons and other things and chopping up containers of booze and other. And it seemed to me like, well, okay, that was their idea of temperance. Now, well-intentioned, but poorly executed, I suppose, you might say. And so that word kind of fell out of line, but most modern translations have self-control rather than temperance. Now, Webster's Illustrated Dictionary, it's one of them that I have there that I use quite often, says that temperance or self-control is moderation, self-control, you see, it's restraint from overindulgence of any kind. Now, that would mean overindulgence in something that would be, you know, bad for you. Overindulgence in consumption of alcohol. But now, you know, there could also be the overindulgence in something that might be good for you. That's the case. Whatever that might be. You know, there are certain medicines that are good for us, but overindulgence in them can be, you know, a disaster. Especially when someone decides to self-medicate. I had a relative, and they told them, you know, one pill do you some good. And the one day took the one pill, and they thought, well, that just did just great. So before, you know what happened next, don't you? Before you knew it, they were taking two. Thinking, oh, I'll feel a whole lot better. And by the time this, you know, escalating self-medication reached its, almost its end, ended up in the hospital. So, you know, it could be overindulgence in any way. But that's the idea of self-control. Now, the Greek word that's used here is the word, now the G is pronounced like an N. Don't ask me why, that's just the Greek language. And it would be enkratia. And this is a word that comes from the root word, kratos, that means strength. Now, Robertson's word picture says that it means holding oneself in. Now, that's a pretty good picture in the word pictures, you see, which is what he always tried to do. So you could see, you know, you're holding yourself in. Now, not somebody else is doing this, but that you're doing this. Now, that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about someone else controlling us. I think one of the great fallacies that there is in religion today, now speaking about this for just a second, is that there are people that decide, I'm going to turn my life over and let Jesus control everything. And sometimes when folks say that, now not everybody, but sometimes folks say, I'm going to let Jesus control everything and I'm going to do nothing.
And they think that's what it ought to be. And I think to myself, well, now, if it's really true that Jesus would, you know, control every move that you would make when you turn over control to him and so on, where's self-control come in here? Well, there wouldn't be any. Self-control would be compromised if someone else had all the control. But I think what's really meant by this, and what we ought to mean by it, is that we are going to let Jesus tell us what to do. And he'll tell us what to do. He'll guide our steps, direct our ways. Like it says in the Old Testament many times in the book of Psalms, also in, you know, Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 23. And then we hear these directions, and then we practice the self-control to do what Jesus tells us to do. Now, that's how it ought to work, not the other way where, you know, really, you know, there's nothing done. And so this is the idea of holding oneself in, you know, that's something that I've got to do, you've got to do. Anyone who wants to practice self-control has to do that. Mr. Thayer says, it's the virtue of one who masters his desires and passions, and especially his sensual appetites. Well, yeah, and it's used most of the time that way when you see something and it may not have the word there, but you see that's what it's talking about. And there are many passages that direct us in that way. The International Standard Bible Encyclopedia has just simply self-mastery as one possible. Self-mastery. I've got the master of myself. Sounds good, but now it's not something that's easy. It's something that you have to work at. Something that you have to actually, you know, try to accomplish. And I thought, as far as some examples go, I thought of a couple of them. Now, they're Old Testament examples. But they're examples of a lack of self-control and practicing self-control. Joseph practiced self-control, didn't he? Genesis chapter 39, 7 through 10 is that business with Potiphar's wife. You remember how that goes? Oh, there's nobody around. Nobody will know the difference. And they're just you and me. And she says, come over here and lay with me. She was interested in taking a nap. Now, I think we understand what was going on. And he wouldn't do it. He refused. To the point that, you know, he finally just escaped her clutches. Literally. So he practiced self-control. Good for him. But then we get down here to David and the business with Bathsheba. 2 Samuel 11, 1 through 4. We probably all are familiar with that. When he could have practiced some self-control, but he didn't. Now he saw and he let this get in his head, bounce around in there. He thought about it. Pretty soon it's consuming his thinking. He sends someone, bring that woman over here. Well, so there you got it. I think just two good examples of one who did and one who didn't. And so, you know, we can understand, you know, how it all is. We can talk about definitions. And we can see from these good examples, you know, when you get right down to it, that's what's going on. Now, the usage of the word self-control in the New Testament is found in very few places, actually, that word enkratia, or a form of it. Acts chapter 24. Go there for just a moment. Verse 25. Paul here is, he's in the lockup, we might say. And there's been a change in the one who was the governor. It had gone from from Felix to Festus, but now it's Felix here in verse 25. And the thing about it is, you look at verse 24, now he's before, you know, Felix and his wife Drusilla. I'm not going to go into a long explanation or description of these individuals or give their history, but sometimes you ought to look it up. Boy, what a couple characters they were. And yet, it says in verse 25 that he reasoned about righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come. Apparently, he did this to Felix and Drusilla. Because Felix was afraid and answered, go away when I have a convenient time, I'll call for you.
So, you know, Felix wanted him to stop doing that kind of thing. But the thing is that it was the very thing that Felix and Drusilla needed to hear. And especially did they need to hear about self-control, because personally they didn't practice any at all. And there was a lot of people as Roman officials. The higher up they went, the less self-control there was. That's just how it worked. But now righteousness, as he talks about here, righteousness cannot be achieved without self-control. If so, I'd like to know how. It can't. Can't happen at all. And then you think about judgment. He mentions judgment. Well, judgment is based and enhanced by the administration and practice of self-control. So you can see how it works with the other two there. Now, another place it's found is in Galatians chapter 5, verses 22-23. That's where the fruit of the Spirit is. And you get down there to the end of the list, and there's temperance in the King James, or self-control in newer translations. So it's among the fruit of the Spirit, things that are to be prized and to be gained and to achieve all those things. Love, joy, peace, and gentleness, goodness, faith, all these things. Meekness, self-control. Now also it's found in 2 Peter chapter 1. Verses 5 through 7. Sometimes we call those the Christian graces. That's fine. But you know, that's the, you add to your faith, virtue. To virtue, knowledge. To knowledge, self-control. Self-control is one of the things that needs to be added to faith. And again, all these things that they're added to faith, they enhance faith. I used to make the illustration this way. A person builds a house. And after you build the house, you add things to the house. You add shutters. Let's say, we had a neighbor one time that was going to sell their house, and they wanted to kind of spruce it up just a little bit, and they had me come over and add shutters to the windows on the front of the house. Well, pretty easy job. I didn't, you know, enjoy doing it, and they were good neighbors, help them out. Well, that enhanced, you know, the house. And you can add some bushes, you know, or some flowers and other things. And all these are to, you know, enhance the appearance of a house. Well, we add these things. They're mentioned in 2 Peter chapter 1, verse 5. You add those to your faith and they'll enhance your faith. They kind of adorn your faith, if you will. Now also, the word is used as a verb. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, and you find it in verse 25. Everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown, but we for an imperishable crown. Now he's using an illustration here from the athletic games of his time, and talks about the athlete who's competing in here, and he's temperate in all things. He practices self-control. And you think about an athlete, they practice self-control. They watch their diet. They try to get the right amount of sleep. All other things into consideration. There are also things that they, you know, you can't do. You can't go out here. You can't go to the parties and have a great big time and indulge in just whatever and stay out late. You know, you've got to take care of yourself. You've got to train. I remember Lance Armstrong saying, everybody thinks, you know, training is just some wonderful thing. He said, I'll tell you what. He said, you wait till it's a cold, rainy day and you go out and ride on a bicycle 6 hours in the mountains. And you'll find out that's not very enjoyable, but you got to do it when you're training. There's lots of things. I didn't much like to train when I was involved in sports in high school. But now I also understood that if I didn't like it, that was one thing, but it was something that was necessary to do. And he's saying here, you know, that that's what it is. You have to be temperate in all things. You have to practice this self-control. Now, he's not just talking about the games in particular. He's using them to talk about being a Christian. Just like that athlete, we've got to be temperate. We've got to practice self-control. We've got to watch ourselves. We've got to watch what the input is and the output, just like an athlete would.
and make sure that everything's proper.
Self-control, go to Galatians chapter 5. Self-control appears to me to be a major factor in nearly every aspect of Christianity. When you see the self-control there in the fruit of the Spirit, there in chapter 5, Galatians chapter 5, I want to back up just a little bit to 16 through 18. Walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lusts of the flesh. For the flesh lusts against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh, and these are contrary to one another, so that you do not do the things that you wish. But if you are led by the Spirit, you are not under the law. Now just think about those three verses and what they say, and just think to yourself now, how does self-control work in there? And would that be a good thing? Well, yeah. Yeah, it would work well with this, and yes, it would be a good thing. Then you go over to chapter 6, verse 7 and 8. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. For he who sows to his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption, but he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. How about self-control there? Yeah, it worked there real well and be very profitable there also. And I think it's easy, as I said earlier, to focus on self-control in the sense of being anti-evil. And that's probably what we think of. First and foremost, well, self-control means don't do a bunch of things that are evil or sinful or wicked. But now, self-control is also used whenever it's pro-good. There's self-control there. Here's some passages that are familiar to us. 1 Corinthians chapter 13. 1 Corinthians chapter 13 and verses 4 through 7. Love suffers long and is kind. Love does not envy. Love does not parade itself, is not puffed up, does not behave rudely, does not seek its own, is not provoked, thinks no evil, does not rejoice in iniquity, but rejoices in the truth. Well, it starts off with a positive thing that it suffers long and is kind, but then you see there's a whole lot of do not, do not, do not, do not. Self-control in those do nots. Oh yeah, we see that, Terry. Well, there's self-control in the love suffers long and it is kind too. And here's another thing. How about verse 7? Bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. There's self-control there as well. So self-control goes both ways. And we don't want to just have, you know, some tunnel vision and think it's just going in just one direction. In Philippians chapter 4, 6 through 8, Paul has some words to say there. He goes through a whole thing. Whatever things are good, whatever things are just, another. Then when he gets to verse 8, he says, here's what you need to do. You need to think on these things. In other words, concentrate on these things. That's going to take self-control, isn't it? Philippians 4, verse 8. Yeah, self-control there as well. Now, what I'd like for us to do in the remainder here is take a look at Colossians chapter 3, verse 1 through 4. Now, just a few things, not very many. But I think that here, we could go a lot of places, but I like this mainly because, well, it's some of my favorite passages are right here. And I think there's practical advice for developing self-control in these verses. If then you were raised with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ is, sitting at the right hand of God. Set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth. For you died, and your life is hidden with God in Christ. When Christ, who is our life, appears, you also will appear with Him in glory. So what's he saying here? What's the practical advice for developing self-control? Well, the very first thing is, put first things first. That's the very first thing. Easy to say, hard to do. Made easier, though, if you can get a handle on self-control and practice some of that. He says here that you are raised with Christ. Now we know about being raised with Christ. A person who's baptized into his death, raised to walk in newness of life. And we got newness of life here. A little self-control, if you will. The old man's dead. Leave him behind. Move away from that. Move into that new life that you're walking in, you've been raised to. Well, that's some good advice. Sure it is. And then he says, and this is important. The New King James to have tonight says, seek those things which are above. The New American Standard Bible has, keep seeking. Which is probably a better translation because the word seeking there is continual action. So it's like, you know, you keep on seeking. Or how's this? Don't stop seeking. But don't stop seeking those things which are above. Now, one of the parables, Matthew chapter 13, verses 45 through 46. The kingdom of heaven is like a merchant seeking beautiful pearls. Now, not just any pearls, certain ones, beautiful pearls. There'll be some self-control there, isn't there? Not going to just take anything that comes along. And then when he found one pearl of great price, he went and sold all that he had and bought it. That would really take some self-control to do that, to realize, you know, this is it. And I've got to get rid of everything for that. Now, the idea here is not just tell people how to go out and find pearls and how to buy them if you find a good one. That's not the point. The point is that when you find truth, when you find truth, you give up everything for truth. It comes first and foremost. The salvation of our souls, it's right up there with truth because the truth of God's Word is all about the salvation of our souls. So you put first things first. And you keep them there. Now another thing he says here is, you know, you kind of tune up your mind. That's my wording there. But what he really says is you set your mind. But the idea is, you know, is tune up your mind. You know, get it going. Get it going in the right direction. Get it running right. Mr. Strong says about this, I thought this was pretty good. To exercise the mind, that is, to entertain or have a sentiment or opinion. Do you know how many people there are today that don't have a sentiment or an opinion on something? Have you ever tried it? You talk to somebody about something that's of importance, whether it's something that's dominating the news or something that's local or something in the neighborhood, you know, and you talk to somebody about it. And you get one of these, I'm neither here nor there on it. And it's fine. Sometimes, you know, we need to be just neither here nor there. We don't have to do this on everything. But once in a while, you think we could have a sentiment or an opinion about things. But, I mean, it just seems like, you know, my generation, ever since I was just a little fella, you know, to find out that that's how people are. Won't go either way on it. So, you remember Peanuts? You remember that? And you remember Charlie Brown? And Lucy would be pressing Charlie Brown, you know, to take a position on something, and he wouldn't do it. You remember what she called him? Wishy-washy. Yeah. And we've got let me go one step. You know, we got folks like this in the church. I'm afraid to say. But that's the truth of it now. It is. We got people that, you know, are supposed to set your mind and ought to be exercising the mind and ought to be able to entertain or have a sentiment or opinion on something. But I mean, they can go for years and there's nothing. And I don't know what it is. Now, sometimes I think they actually know the difference in right and wrong. They just don't want to commit themselves. But then I also realize that sometimes they've not exercised the mind. You know, they've been kind of just going through the motions. You know, kind of just sitting there. And it's all going past them. And then when it comes down, I don't know. I don't have any idea. I haven't been listening. Huh? Sounds like me in government class in high school. Teacher would be up there. We had a great teacher. I mean, he was just brilliant on this stuff. He knew it inside and out, upside and upside down and all these and backwards and forwards. And he would be up there talking about this and everything. I mean to tell you, you know what it was doing with me? Right on past, you know. And then if he asked me a question, I was pretty well done for. I wasn't listening. I wasn't paying any attention.
I think that happens sometimes to members of the church. You can sit there and sit there and sit there, but these other things aren't happening. And then in the end, well, there's no... I don't know. I really can't say anything because I've just been kind of going through the motions. Or I've been fed a diet of something that appears to be spiritual, but there's no meat in it. It's all just milk. That can happen. But now here's another thing. You can't mix the things of the flesh and the things of the spirit and then claim self-control. That's not going to work that way. Now, I've got these passages up here in Romans chapter 8, 5 through 17. And you can see just so much down through there. Look at verse 5. Those who live according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh, but those who live according to the Spirit, the things of the Spirit. Where's the mixing up here between the two? Well, there isn't any. But for to be carnally minded is death, but to be spiritual minded is life and peace. Exactly. For the carnal mind is enmity against God, is not subject to the law of God, nor indeed can be. So then, those who are on the flesh cannot please God. But you who are not in the flesh, but in the Spirit, if indeed the Spirit of God dwells in you. Now, if anyone does not have the Spirit of Christ, he is not his. And it goes on with the same idea. In other words, it comes a time you can't mix this up, and really you can't just sit there and go by without any idea, any sentiment, any opinion about anything, never taking a position, and think that on the day of judgment, well done, good and faithful servant. Well, I wouldn't be counting on it in a case like that, because we are expected to practice self-control, and when you practice self-control, sooner or later, you're going to be called on to say that something's right and something's wrong. You're going to have to do that. You're going to have to do that on a personal level. You're going to have to do that on a family level. You're going to have to instill that into loved ones, children, whoever it is, that there's right and wrong. And so, yeah, we're going to have to do this. It's incumbent on us to do it for ourselves and for others. He also goes on to say, well, you have died. And if you've died, that results in a changed state, doesn't it? Well, we see that in baptism, Romans chapter 6, verses 3 through 4. Rise to walk in newness of life. Then there's Matthew chapter 16, verses 24 and 25. If anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself. Now, I want to stop. How much self-control is there in denying oneself? How much is there? You deny yourself. That's not saying deny yourself certain things. It's to deny self. To deny self. Don't let self rule, say. Now, practice a self-control. Do what God says to do. Not what self might like or thinks best and other things along that line. Take up his cross and follow me, for whosoever desires to save his life will lose it. And whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. Now there's self-control all over both of those passages, and I think we can see that. Now, one more thing here. We're told in Philippians chapter 2 and verse 5, let the mind of Christ be in you. So let the mind of Christ be our mind. Be my mind, be your mind. Well, that's going to change a whole lot of things in here, isn't it? That's right. And that's going to take some self-control. Yes, it does. And self-control is something that it's going to be practiced all the time. You can't just let up, because you know what happens when you let up on something? It kind of slips away. It's like holding the leash on a dog. You let up on that a little bit, and the next thing you know, leash is out of your hand, there goes the dog. And my chances of catching him would be nil. I can't run anymore. But you get the idea. You let up, and things change. Things slip away from you. Let up with self-control, what happens? Well, something else enters into the picture. Something else gets in there, and it eats away at all the good and all everything that you've gained. And that's a sad part of it. But we need to let the mind of Christ be our mind all the time and be determined
to do that. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6 is our last passage. And we'll kind of go into the invitation on that. But you might also take your songbooks out, turn the song that's been selected. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 6 is a passage that's familiar with us. Without faith, it is impossible to please Him. For he who comes to God must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. Diligently seek Him. I think to myself, well, there's self-control again there, isn't there? That's right. The faith that we ought to have, the faith that pleases God, is going to be connected with the diligence of seeking God. Self-control. And what we need to do, that it starts with self-control and faith, and then doing whatever it is that comes after that. Repenting of sin. That's self-control in there. You think about repenting sin. Changing the mind, changing life. Self-control all over that. And then what? Well, how about being baptized? That takes self-control as well. In a world that thinks that baptism, thinks anything about salvation, is absolutely a wasted effort. You're going to make an effort to demonstrate and to seek the salvation that's offered from the Lord, the forgiveness of sins. And that's going to take some self-control to do that. And then to continue after that, faithful unto death. We help someone to do that tonight. If you're subject to the gospel invitation, this is the right place. This is the right time. If you're subject, why don't you come all together? We stand and sing.